So did she have regret about becoming a picture bride?
Well, in the end, when I put her in that, NHK came to do the 100-year documentary, and I was the guide for Mr. Yamazaki, and I had included Tazawa's story. They loved her story. And so after she did that, she was the first one to appear in that documentary. And then that showed throughout Japan, and it appeared in Fukushima, and she made the front page, full page, her story. And the priest that the church that she temple that she used to attend as a young girl, the priest even sent her the newspaper clipping and a congratulatory letter to Mrs. Tazawa. And she told me, "Oh, Kawakami-san, I feel so grateful to you for putting me on TV. I never thought, when I came as the picture bride, my life was so miserable. She went through so much of suffering." And she said, "But now she can die anytime," she said. "In Japan, you don't have a chance to appear on TV, right?" And so all her friends wrote to her to congratulate her. And she said that's the happiest thing that ever happened to her. And she was the toughest person to interview. She didn't grant me the interview. I heard about her, from other people. I called her about three, four times. She kept on saying, no, And then finally I got to her. I said, "I don't know how I did." I said, "I just want to meet her and talk to her." But once she met me, she gave me all the story, how, about even her husband, and her husband, had so many girlfriends and all that. And it just poured out of her. She trusted me. She was like a mother to me. And so I think with interviews, funny how I build good rapport with all the people. I don't think they would have confided and, expressed so much their inner feelings if I think if they didn't
They
if
felt
they didn't
comfortable with you,
yeah, I
right?
think they trusted me. And that's the reason why I cannot, just give the interviews, I mean the tapes, But
Can you describe how life was different? Like, one of the things that I'm looking at is how women had a harder time in plantation life than men.
Adapting?
In many different, I mean, they,
Adapting to new life or
no, just
no?
like how women got less pay, how women had housework to do on top of their day work, how it's a patriarchy, right? Men are the boss. So can you talk about how women's lives were different from men's lives, and particularly with the picture brides?
I think for women, the adaptation to foreign soil, that alone was difficult. Coming as a new bride, and even the clothing, climate-wise, environment, everything was so different for them. And they didn't know how to cook. Many of them didn't know how to cook, and so that was another diff obstacle to overcome. And when they started working, like one woman, Mrs. Kikugawa, told me about how when she started working in a pineapple field, they didn't have money. And so as a young bride, she used to pick the Spanish fly, the black thing that sticks into your trouser when you walk through the fields. They call it something Spanish plant anyway. It has a lot of the sharp things, And so she used to pick the young shoots and use that for a main dish to boil it for dinner, just the leaves, And her husband would say, "Oh, it's delicious, Here are the newlyweds." And so I think for them to adapt to new life and then working situation, like Mrs. Toki told me, as soon as she came here, entered her new home, her mother-in-law already had the work clothes all ready for her. She had just arrived from Japan on a long 10-day voyage. She was so exhausted, and yet she had to start working right away and, get dressed in the kasuri jacket with skirt and cummerbund and all the things that in Japan she only wore kimono. She came with a kimono. None of the Japanese picture brides had dresses. They all came with kimonos, and they never learned to. They never saw sewing machines back in the village, because kimono was always hand sewn. And so for them, it was really a great, you know, a drastic exchange in the way of life. And so this one picture by was interesting, Ankawai Koloa. She came in 1911, and she was a very tall woman, you know, the about 5'6". And yeah, her entryway was exciting too, because when they to Kauai, you take the kinau, you know, the smaller boats to go to Kauai, and they have to anchor it offshore because the piers are so small. They transfer the brides all dressed in kimono, and you know how difficult riding their canoe in a kimono. And here, when they landed at the Koloa landing, I went to see it because I wanted to know what it looked like. It's on a steep hill, you know, and the landing is, of course, the landing, they took it away. It's just a pier, a small pier. And the canoe goes right near, and the picture bar is in the kimono, which is so restricted, you know, tight. And they had to jump on the pier. When the canoe, you know, when the wave goes up, that's when they have to jump up to the pier. And so Mrs. Kimura was one of the taller brides. The shorter brides, 4 feet eight, 4 feet 10, they could, you know, quickly jump up to the pier, but she said she couldn't. She was the tallest one. She was embarrassed, you know. No matter how she tried, when the boat bobbed up, she tried to jump on the pier, she couldn't. So a big Hawaiian man from the pier scooped her up and put her on the pier. And she was embarrassed, you know. She said in Japan, no man had ever held her. And so she's a young bride, right? In Japan, men and women were segregated, you know. Different. There was a difference, you know, the way the families and parents treated the son and daughter. And so for her, it was a culture shock. Just to have the Hawaiian man lift her, you know, she was embarrassed because no man had even touched her before. That's interesting. And then,
how did she end up meeting her groom?
No, that was the picture bride marriage. So,
right. So how did she end up?
Oh, the groom was waiting. No, I think, I think the groom must have come, and I don't know, it's a funny small landing. So that part, I think, but anyway, she was taken to a new home, all the earthen floor, dirt floor, only one room, a shack. You know, this is in Kilauea Plantation, one of the oldest. Koloa is the oldest plantation, but Kilauea Plantation is just as old, you know. And so it was just a one-room shack. Her table, first table, was an apple box put together, you know, as a table. And dirt floor, and only there one room to sleep in and to eat and everything. And the strange thing is, her husband had a single sewing machine, 1911. And he was, you know, the bachelors, because there was no woman around to do the patchwork and everything, they had pitched in to buy the single sewing machine in 1911. And so her husband was sewing a Japan flag, you know, with the rising sun. Those days when Emperor's birthday, people, you know, decorated the Japan flag. So he was sewing the Japan flag. So what she did, she wondered what the strange looking thing was. Because in Japan, she never saw a machine. You see, imagine. And so after she fooled around with it, you know, and knew how to operate it, she finished sewing the Japan flag. And then later, from the neighborhood woman, she started to, you know, borrow patterns and started working, sewing her work clothes. The first set, a neighbor woman had sewn her the three-piece outfit, the skirt, jacket, and cummerbund, you know, for her to work in the fields immediately. And so after that, she said she took apart some clothing to copy the pattern, and she started, you know, making clothes, you know, for other people too. And it was a very painstaking process. They didn't know how to sew, and first time using the sewing machine. And then also to, like when they started working in the fields, men and women did hapaiko together. And it was very hard carrying the, you know, hapaiko is you get bundle of cane, you know, you cut the cane first, pula pula stage, just cutting the cane into about, you know, 2 foot length. And then after that, you have to pile it, you know, some are, you know, like they call it piler, you know, they pile the long, you know, the harvested sugar cane, burnt sugar cane into bundles, and they have to carry into the cane car. And so according to Mrs. Toki, for her it was very hard. They worked together. And there was a farm woman. She was much, much smaller. Mrs. Toki was very tall for a Japanese woman. She was about 5'5". And then this other farm woman, she's only about 4'8". But because she came from a farming village, she was used to all that hard work in the rice fields. And so she could work in the sugar cane field. She was so fast, and the faster you work, you know, the pay was better if you worked as a couple. Few pennies, better, you know. And so Mr. Toki would get so angry with his wife because she said, oh, your body big, but, you know, you're no good for work, good for nothing. And oh, she said sometimes she felt like crying. And he would go on a sit-down strike right there in the field because he would compare her with that other small woman who was such a fast worker. So her husband benefited. And so Ms. Toki said that was a very trying time for her. And so, but then she was a very smart woman because she graduated as a valedictorian from her Japanese school after sixth grade. And so eventually, she did good work in the sugarcane fields, you know, as she adapted to life on the plantation. So,
how did she adapt? How did she get better?
I think it's just instinct and I think observation. They observe the smart ones, you know, they observe the other women, and they work with different women of different ethnic groups. And I think you have to. Some people were very sharp, you know, they could pick up things very quickly. And Mrs. Toki was very smart because in the end, when I interviewed her at the final stage, she told me during World War II, she's the only Eastern woman that, as a picture bride, you know, she worked for the military. She was working on the plantation, Wailua Plantation. And then at that time, she... amazing, because the Wailua Plantation had cooperated with the military, World War II effort, growing vegetables, because ships were difficult, you know, they couldn't import things, you know, from the mainland, you know, fresh vegetables and all. So the Wailua Plantation had land to spare, so they started growing vegetables. And Mrs. Toki was so bright, she couldn't speak good English, but she picked up here and there. So they selected her to be the supervisor for the school children, elementary school kids. They worked for only, what, 25 cents a day, working there in a vegetable garden. And she supervised, taught them how to select, like, string beans. She would teach them, this is too young, and the middle ones are tender and nice. And the ones that overgrown, you know, get so hard, you know, they're already seeds. So she couldn't speak well, but somehow she got through to the children. And then she said she was the only one who could, the military people gave her a ride on the military truck and took her home. So the other ladies used to hate her. She said she wasn't popular because they used to envy her because she got double the pay, you know.
Yeah. Well, when you say that in terms of working on the plantation, that some people were smart and they would pick things up, like I'm assuming about how to work faster.
Yes.
What were
efficient being
what,
more?
How? What were some of those tricks of being more efficient?
I don't think you're just you have the strength. Some people the body was more, you know, conditioned for hard work. Like Mrs. Asato, amazing. She was a big woman too from Okinawa. Back home, they had sugar cane fields in Okinawa because they raised the sugar, right? And so she was already conditioned to hard work. So the Okinawan women who came at picture buyers, I found out it wasn't much stress for them working in the sugarcane fields and pineapple fields because the body was made, you know, for work. And so she said she produced, you know, more. You have to fill up your bags, you know, like pula pula. It was heavy, you know, you have to make the seedlings and then stuff it into the burlap bag. And some people couldn't carry it because they're about 100 pounds by the time you fill it. And Mrs. Asato was the only one. Mrs. Kumasaka, another picture bride, and her, they worked as partners sometimes, you know. And she said, oh, Mrs. Asato was the only one who could carry, just like men. She carried 100 pounds each on both shoulders. And that was very rare. She was famous for that.
Can you talk about ways that women would help the picture brides adapt? Like, did they teach them how to cook? Or were there things that the women's, that friendships that developed to help support the picture bride adapt?
There was a lot of, you know, the we call it social network, actually. Because women, I think, because women always go through the same, life cycle. You know, they have the menstruation, giving birth. You have all the symptoms, you know, the bodily change. And so I think women have a natural tendency to help each other.
Can you say that again?
Women have natural tendency to help each other. And they could sort of sense it. You know, some women were so slow. And so they had to, even Mrs. Toki, she herself was slow, but later on when she became more efficient and she got better pay, she helped the ones who were slower, you know, to learn how to do it faster. So it's amazing how in the fields, especially people working with people, Portuguese, Hawaiian, there are a few Hawaiian women, and of course some Chinese women, and a lot of Portuguese, Spanish women, that they were thrown together to work as a group. And in doing so, daily they learned about food differences, they exchanged recipes, and of course Japanese always brought rice, and Portuguese people brought the pandula, you know, the delicious Portuguese bread that they baked in the brick oven. And Japanese women love that too, you know. And so they learn to exchange food, and about sewing especially. They didn't know how to do sewing, so it was the Hawaiian, Portuguese, Spanish, and there were Norwegian and German women too in the early stages on the plantation. And so they learned how to fashion the long skirts. They didn't know how to gather, make gathers, you know, for the skirts. So Mrs. Kumasaka told me when she first bought her sewing machine when she came as a picture bride. She was one of the late ones. I think she came in 1922. She bought her first single sewing machine for $100. Imagine, at that time was big money, but today it's so expensive. And so she didn't know how to put in gathers. She just learned, you know, she would push it so, you know, the gathers would be so uneven, you know, more like pleated. Some are large pleats, some are small. And so somehow, and she said, when she first borrowed a pattern from a neighbor woman, sometimes got too tight, and then she had to rip it off. So she had to rip it off about half a dozen times, you know, to make an outfit. So it was very hard. And the thing that when she worked in the fields, because of the language barrier, her Luna was a Hawaiian man, big Hawaiian man. He had a whip. And, you know, she was supposed to, you know, the new sugar cane, the field was very new. There were young shoots coming out. She wasn't supposed to cut the shoots, but because she didn't understand the Luna, the supervisor, with her cut cane, she chopped off all the new shoots from the, you know, the sugar cane. And so the Hawaiian Luna got so angry with her and yelled at her and threw the cut cane at her. And she said she shuddered and she just sat there and cried and wondered why she ever came to Hawaii. You know, she longed to be back home. She said she never felt so miserable, and she thought the Luna was going to kill her with the cut cane knife. See, not knowing, because they didn't understand the English, you know. Mrs. Kaigo, too, another picture bride who came in 1916, she had a miserable time too because she only did sewing back home, and later on Kauai, she did a very she became a hairdresser. You know, she used to dress the Nisei brides when she came from Japan. You know, she learned how to dress the you know, the do formal bridal attire. She learned that in Japan when she returned in 1930, because she couldn't have children. So she was from Yamaguchi Prefecture, but she heard about the Hiroshima Medical School where, you know, people who were childless could have children. So she wanted a, you know, child so badly. She returned 1930, and for 2 years while waiting and having so many surgeries, you know, she took up the formal bridal attire, you know, how to dress a formal bride. And the
okay, but what were you going to say about how she was having such a hard time in the fields?
Yeah, because she was more her home, you know, she only knew kimono sewing. She never worked in the fields. So when she came to Hawaii, she couldn't do field work. Her body was frail, you know. She wasn't accustomed to doing farm work. So instead, she did sewing because she couldn't do it. Instead, she became a formal, you know, a bridal attire, a dresser, you know, costume dresser.
Well, like with the story that you were telling before about the woman who had the Luna throwing things at her.
Yeah.
How did she adapt? How did she
learn to understand? I think later, I think someone, she had talked to a Japanese person who could speak English. And probably related, you know, that story to that Luna. And I think the Luna really felt badly, you know, because he didn't mean to, you know, throw the katken knife at her. You know, I guess he was kind of temperamental. So after that, you know, I think it was okay. But they worked so hard. And she and the husband both sometimes worked together, did the same job for 10 hours a day. And if her husband got paid, you know, $1 a day, she got paid 75 cents a day for 10 hours of work. And for the woman, it was hard. She lived in Pump 4. She had to walk about a mile and a half to come to the main station to catch the train to work. And we lived in Camp 1, and the train station was right below our home. So from Palm 4, where she lived, it's so isolated. Imagine getting up 3:30 in the morning, preparing her husband's breakfast, and then, you know, cooking rice out of doors, you know? And then she had to pack the double-decker lunch can for her husband and herself. And so, and then walk about, you know, I think it's 2 miles, you know, from Pump 4. And then work 10 hours a day. And then go home again, walk home from the train station near our home to her Pump 4 residence. And right away, she had to make the furo for her husband because her husband's tired. The woman would always think about her husband first. Typical Japanese tradition. You know, especially when they're brought up during the Confucian days, you know, when in Japanese school during the Meiji period, even we were taught all the Confucian ethics in Japanese school in Hawaii. And so right away, here she's tired, but she thought of her husband first. So, you know, her husband was able to soak in a hot tub and be relieved on the days, you know, all the aches and pains. And she had to start cooking and do laundry, you know, so that the laundry be clean for next day. And then late at night, after everything was done, she had to, you know, wash the rice for next day, you know. And so for the woman, especially when they had children, she told me how sad it was when she had a daughter and son. And, you know, she would, when they were old enough, she would leave them at the baby home, a nursery in a plantation. And in the dark, you know, she had to leave the girl in the nursery, and she would cry and tell her mother not to leave her alone. And she said, oh, the crying would linger, you know, in her ear until she turned the corner. And she said she started crying, and she had to walk all the way back to the train station, you know, to catch the train. So it's very heartbreaking when I hear the tapes. Even now, I start crying because for them, you know, the language barrier was the worst thing, because eventually they learned to speak little pidgin English, Hapa we call it. And it was, for the Japanese immigrants, it was a mixture of Portuguese, Filipino, Hawaiian, like pao or kau kau, you know, that's Hawaiian. And so a lot of pula pula, that's Hawaiian. And so there was a mixture of Chinese, all kinds of language, all mixed into, really they call it the Creole language, that's more likely, instead of pidgin. Because they picked up the Creole, it's a language they made up on their own, you know. But interviewing Okinawan people were the very hardest, because they retained the old Chinese dialect, Chinese language, which is part of the Okinawan dialect. So,
well, you were saying that language made things really difficult. Were there other challenges that were there that made it hard for picture brides to adapt? I mean, did they have family? Did they? You were saying that a lot of times they had family that were already in Hawaii.
Very few. Like my mother too, she didn't have sisters or brothers here when my father died. And same as, you know, so many of them, they were all alone. They had no one to lean on. So they had to depend on the neighbors. And the most important thing was, especially the funeral section where I wrote, you know, the Reverend and UH Press were so impressed with the funeral section, because it's all my own story, what I observed as a young girl. When a person died in the village, you know, in the camp, it was sad because all of them didn't have money, you know, to afford a decent funeral. Even my father, I still remember, he had a good job, but yet, you know, he had a redwood, you know, coffin made out of redwood. And I remember, you know, and I asked my brother what he wore to walk to the temple, and my brother said he doesn't even remember wearing slippers. I think he went barefooted. You know, things were that bad. So you can imagine, when a person died in the village, I talk about the shroud. In Japan, people dress the deceased in a white shroud made of, like, sarashi is, that's a cheesecloth, like, you know, very narrow material. Comes about, you know, 12, 14 inches wide, and very soft, so that when a person dies, you know, you want them to be comfortable to go to the other world, you know, something soft and pure white. And so all the neighbor women, no matter how busy, when somebody died, they all rested from the work and made time to sew the shroud, you know. And that's the only time when people sew one garment together. And my mother always taught me that no matter how busy I am sewing gowns or whatever, not to let one person sew one sleeve and I sew one sleeve, because the only time you do that is when a person dies. You know, so many people get together.
Well, you were saying, before that, you were talking about how it was really difficult because people didn't have family members here, so...
Yeah, most of them didn't have family members.
So what made that difficult? I mean, why did that make things?
Because immediate family would right away, like, see, when my older sister died, we all helped, right? You know, my brother flew in from LA to help, and then I'm the only sister, so, you know, I had to help with a lot of things that they didn't even know about the past, you know. But in the old immigration days, there were no washing machines, no electric iron, right? This is a real primitive time, actually. And so people had to, there's no money, so people made things. You know, today you have catering. Those days, they made their own nishime, people pitched in, things that they grew in the garden, the vegetables they gathered, and, you know, somehow, they, and then sekihan, you know, the azuki rice that you make. People pitched in, and the neighbors were like your family. They became your family. You had to depend, because there's no one, your blood kin, living nearby to help you out. So financially, if you didn't have any money, they were the ones that pitched in. And so it's amazing how, you know, if you don't have things, people just automatically, naturally have the instinct, you know, to help without asking anything in return. I think that's the beauty of immigration period as I grew up and know that period, you know. It's a beautiful feeling of just giving without asking anything in return. Like Mrs. Muroda, you know, her story.
I have like 2 more minutes, so can you...
What do you want me to... Yeah.
You can tell that story.
Okay. I think that's a very rare story. When I went to interview her about the raincoat in, you know, Waianae, that the people in Waianae, instead of... Because they were isolated, they were going through more hardship. And to do the raincoat, to make it water repellent, they had to buy a bottle, you know, 75 cents each to buy that astringent juice of, you know, the persimmon to make the cloth water repellent. But people in Waianae use the bark and, you know, sap from the kukui nut tree. And then when they fashioned the raincoat, to quicken the story, you know, when Mrs. Muroda was the only midwife in the Waianae area, there were no hospitals then, so to give birth, they had to depend only on Mrs. Muroda. And so sometimes women, because to make the extra dollar, they were paid $25 per month, you know, for 10 hours of work a day. And they knew they were expecting the baby anytime. You see many women very pregnant in their work clothing. And just to get that extra dollar bonus, they would go work in the fields. And so sometimes emergency, you know, Mrs. Muroda was called and there were no cars. So if the camp police was available, he would rush the midwife to the fields. But many times she took the mule or the horse, you know, to go miles into the cane field to deliver the baby. And according to Mr. Muroda, he was about 9 years old when he was working among this older woman. She said, oh, people were so kind. You know, as soon as they knew the woman was expecting, they would dig a hole in the, you know, the furrow, the cane fields, you know, the rows of the furrow. They would build a, make a hole, and they would place that kapa, the raincoat, you know, into the hole. And then the workers would all, the water boy who... carried the water, you know, in the 2 pails, you know, on a pole. He would volunteer to lend his pail and, you know, boil water to bathe the baby, newborn baby. And everybody would scurry around gathering twigs and leaves, you know, to build a fire. And right there in the fields, you know, the midwife would come and, you know, deliver the baby, wash in that, you know, the kapa, the raincoat, handmade at home, you know. The oily part is a water repellent, so she will put that on the bottom side, and then they will fill up with the boiling water to bathe a newborn. And so, according to Mr. Muroda, it was so touching that here, those women, you know, so poor, and Japanese women, they were so small, 4 feet 8, 4 feet 10, about the tallest, going to work with the baby strapped on the back, carrying hole and the bento bag. And when this lady unexpectedly gave birth in the field, they would lend the diapers, you know, because they brought the babies to the field. They loaned their diapers to the newborn, you know, mother, so she could have. It's such a heartwarming, you know, touching story. So much giving, you know. And so, okay, they couldn't pay for the midwife because everybody was so poor. And so when Mr. Muroda got married in 1926, all these people who